Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says those responsible for Wednesday's deadly terrorist attack on an Iranian shrine will receive punishment for their crime. Tehran and Moscow tell a UN Security Council session that Western allegations about Russia using Iranian drones against Ukraine are totally untrue. And the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the maritime deal with the Israeli regime is a big victory for Lebanon.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The terrorist attack on a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Shiraz in Fars province leaves over a dozen people dead. Officials have confirmed 15 deaths, which include women and children. Over two dozen others have been injured in the attack at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. A gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then proceeded to the main compound, where he opened fire on pilgrims and staff. Officials say the 30-year-old assailant has been wounded and is now in custody. 3 days of public mourning have been announced in Fars province. Iran's leader has issued a message about the terrorist attack on the holy Shah Cheragh shrine, pledging that those responsible will undoubtedly receive punishment for what they have done. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says recent riots in the country paved the way for the terrorist attack in Shiraz.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
Raisi also said the riots have their roots in the fact that Iran's adversaries have failed to disrupt its progress through other means. He said enemies don't want Iran to develop and prosper. Earlier, Raisi vowed a severe response over the killing of civilians. Separately, Iran's envoy to the UN, Saeed Iravani, called on the Security Council to condemn the terrorist attack. He said it was a, quote, terrible terrorist attack on citizens, including women and children. Iravani said that terrorism is a major threat to international peace and security. Activist and political analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi says a hybrid war has been waged against Iran with the aim of destabilizing the country and its security.
Look at the events step by step, what took place in Iran. It started all with spreading fake news about the Mahsa Amini beaten to death. Then later on, it continued with street riots. And later on, it continued with normalization of the violence in the street. Different media took a great role, US-backed media, United States of America's medias, Saudi-backed medias. They openly dragged the people and pushed the people towards violence. The Persian, medias in Western countries, they invited openly people for violence without any restriction. Then apparently what we observed were attacks on different Iranian security forces that also took place. Later on, what we observed was the activation of the separatist groups inside Iran, taken from Sistan Balochistan province to Kurdistan province, also to some other parts of Iran. And why not a terrorist attack? I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, you will find out that, as I said at the very beginning of my points, a hybrid war is going on against Iran. Different, strategies of war against Iran is now being implemented. And one important conclusion that I can get is that the command center for this hybrid war is the same. The one who is bringing people to the streets with lies that are publishing and making viral here and there are also responsible for what took place in Shiraz yesterday.
Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajareh, says a certain process to demonize Iran is taking place, normalizing the use of violence against supporters of the Islamic Republic.
The Iranian nation, who has been target of terrorism from the time of the revolution and target of atrocities, be it committed by Saddam or by others, Iran has been targeted over and over. And we are facing right now a situation that the demonization process which is taking place against Iran, day in, day out, it really is unprecedented. And it does lead to violence being unleashed, not just in Iran, but elsewhere. I mean, we saw in streets of Europe, mosques being attacked, sort of people who are gathering for Arbaeen being attacked, people's hijabs being forcibly removed, and even, you know, five police officers being put in hospital with broken bones. And similar thing has happened in France and elsewhere. So really this encouragement of violence against Iran and in some ways Islamophobic nature of it, it's very worrying, and it goes beyond what is happening to Iranians. It actually has got sort of implication for all Muslims, because if Iranian sort of Muslim so-called opposition, if they go and burn Quran, remove people's hijab, attack mosque with sort of bottles of beer and wine, then, you know, the racist is a license for racists to come out and unleash their Islamophobia.
The terrorist attack on the Iranian shrine is drawing an outburst of international condemnations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack, calling for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has expressed sympathies with his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. Putin has said that Moscow is ready for increased cooperation with Tehran to fight terrorism. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson has also voiced Beijing's support for Iran's anti-terrorist efforts. Syria, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Oman, and Yemen have also condemned the terrorist act and sent their messages of condolence to the people of Iran. Iran's ambassador to the UN says Tehran has not supplied any weapons for use in the war in Ukraine, either before or after the conflict broke out. Addressing a UN Security Council session, Amir Saeed Irvani rejected all accusations by the U.S. and its Western allies that Iran has delivered drones to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Meanwhile, a Russian permanent representative to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, said the calls by the West for a probe into the use of drones will set a dangerous precedent. He said that such calls are in breach of the UN Charter. He called on the Security Council to condemn the West actions and to defend the Charter. Under the Charter, he said, only the UN Security Council can mandate an investigation and it shall not seek or receive instructions from any government or authority. The U.S. and its Western allies have been pushing the UN Secretariat to organize a probe into the matter. Lebanon and Israel finalized a U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. Officials from both sides separately submitted their signed copies of the deal to U.S. officials and their new coordinates for the maritime boundary to the U.N. That officially brought the deal into force. Earlier, President Michel Aoun signed a letter endorsing the agreement, but he said the accord will not change his country's policy towards Israel and that Lebanon will remain in a state of war with the regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, approved the deal. Just ahead of the signing, UN peacekeepers were deployed in the area. The deal is expected to end a dispute mainly over the Karish gas field. Prior to the agreement, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah had threatened Israel with war if it violated Lebanese rights. The Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says the maritime deal with Israel was a big victory for Lebanon, its people, and resistance. Said Hassan Nasrallah said even the Israeli regime itself admitted it had not gained any security guarantees from Beirut. The Hezbollah chief also echoed President Michel Aoun's remarks that Lebanon will never normalize with the Israeli regime. He said the maritime agreement was reached through indirect negotiations. Nasrallah said delegations from both sides did not meet in the process and that signatures were put on a separate paper. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute. He said the Lebanese resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. Diesel shortages in the U.S. are spreading along the East Coast amid a ban on imports from Russia. There are now fears over a further surge in prices for the fuel as consumers brace for winter. Suppliers have advised customers to give a 72-hour notice for their orders in order to avoid having to pay above-market prices.
The war in Ukraine and a series of interlinked crises across the globe have triggered concerns about energy supplies worldwide. countries are now beginning to look into contingency plans to avert or overcome possible energy crises. And the United States is no exception. Experts have now sounded the alarm bells over possible blackouts in the Northeast and New England regions. Those areas have already begun rationing heating oil as stockpiles slump by 70%. The rationing measures are imposed on consumers, which limit the amount of heating oil they can purchase. It's reported that the U.S. Northeast is so short on heating oil that the fuel used to power home furnaces is being rationed even before the start of winter. The measures have highlighted the extreme fuel tightness in those regions. Scarcity and high costs have triggered gloomy prospects for the coming months. Wholesale heating oil in New York Harbor averaged $4.09 a gallon, compared with $2.46 at the same time a year ago. The emergency situation has prompted many consumers to opt for partial fills. Some say they will not turn on the heat until they absolutely have to. Apart from that, there are warnings that in case of a severe cold spell and amid global gas market volatility, consumers could face blackouts due to not enough gas for power generation.
Diesel supplies in New England, the region most reliant on distillate fuels for heating, have reportedly dwindled to about a third of normal levels this time of the year. The shortages also put the U.S. at risk of further spikes in prices if there's a supply disruption. The rising heating oil prices have now pushed consumers to turn to liquefied natural gas or LNG. But due to the energy crisis in Europe, LNG prices are already sky high and will likely move higher as winter comes.
The rising heating oil prices have now pushed consumers to turn to liquefied natural gas or LNG. But due to an energy crisis in Europe, LNG prices are already sky high and will likely move higher as winter comes. That means that power generation firms would have to pay astronomical prices to bring natural gas to the US Northeast. There are now predictions that the highest wholesale electricity prices are likely to be in New England. Apart from the US domestic markets, LNG is in high demand across the globe. Europe's demand for liquefied natural gas has soared to unprecedented levels given the fact that the continent is trying to wean itself off Russia's gas. The US is now the world's largest exporter of natural gas, but political as well as economic elements will prevent Washington from being Europe's rescuer. European nations are scrambling to store enough gas as winter approaches. President Joe Biden promised in March to export more LNG to Europe.
At the time, I noted that we were able to take this step when others could not because the United States is a net exporter of energy with a strong domestic industry. And the United States welcomed the European Union's powerful statement earlier this month, committing to rapidly reduce its dependence on Russian gas. Today, we've agreed on a joint game plan toward that goal, while accelerating our progress toward a secure, clean energy future.
But the industry in the U.S. is already under pressure. That has prompted some politicians in the U.S. to state that American consumers, economy, as well as national security are at risk unless Washington maintains surplus inventory. Apart from that, much of Europe lacks sufficient import infrastructure, even if America could export more LNG.
Italy's new Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and her right-leaning government won a confidence vote in the Senate after going through the same procedure in the lower house on Tuesday. Meloni has presented a program setting out policy for the full 5-year legislative term. Max Ciavelli has more from Rome.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favor, 79 against, and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election. During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds. Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy chargé d'affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea. Max Civili, Rome.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
It is never too late to learn a new skill. That's what 100-year-old Nada Rudan has shown with her art when she discovered her love for painting at the age of 87. The Bosnian native says she started to paint to keep herself busy, and now she finds the days are often too short to fit in everything she wanted to do. The artist paints for 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon without glasses. Rudan marked her 100th birthday with an exhibition of all the works that she has painted over the years.
My 100th birthday, I've celebrated it at sea. That was really a big event for me. Before that, I had an exhibition that I didn't hope for. But my children persuaded me. I was against it. I'm not an artist. I said, children, don't embarrass me.
She says she's inspired by nature and her travel around the globe. Rudan has lived in numerous areas such as Central America, Hawaii Islands, Europe, and the Asian Himalayas, among many other places. The artist survived both World War II and the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces. Iran's Kish Island is known as the paradise of the Persian Gulf. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali has been to the stunning southern Iranian resort island and has filed this report about its beautiful attractions.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. This snow town is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists, while U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai. The island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
A 78-year-old artist is making a comeback with a unique art installation on Governor's Island in the United States of America. One of its biggest features is the sound and creaking of moving chains.
It's a project that I proposed for a commission in St. Louis. The site of the commission was the area near the Mississippi River and the St. Louis courthouse. So I wanted to do a piece that addressed those areas and, you know, the subjects. And and of course we have in those areas the Mississippi River, which is a place that you talk about the history of American commerce, but also we can talk about the history of slavery.
Charles Gaines wanted to highlight the role slavery played in building the economy of the United States. That's why he purposely used chains, and the sculptor pointedly faces the Statue of Liberty in New York City. The installation is roughly 30 meters long and activated by colossal chains that rotate on anchors. The installation is part of a three-chapter series called The American Manifest, Moving Chains. It will be kept for all to see until the summer of next year.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out three patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
If you have a sweet tooth, then this next bit of news is just for you. Visitors are now taking advantage of the expanded version of Cakeland, which is an immersive art gallery in the U.S. city of Los Angeles. The structure is meant to feel like a giant multi-layered cake. It's entirely made of artificial materials, but looks like if it's full of cherries, whipped cream, and layers of cake. Artist Scott Hoff says he used nearly a ton of pipe frosting, 120 mirrors, and thousands of cherries. Plus, he embedded thousands of crystals in the walls as a final touch. The artist says he chose to develop Cakeland after he noticed how much his artificial cake sculptures were welcomed by viewers.
So I chose cake because, number one, it's really beautiful. Number two, it's really fun to do. And number three, it engages the viewers in such a meaningful way.
Hoff says he never actually made a real cake before and has mainly followed his enthusiasm for fake food as the inspiration for this project. Visitors are able to walk through the cake, a labyrinth, and explore various rooms. While there is a lot of deliciousness and lightness of the cakes, visitors to this cake land can discover some interesting darker elements as they wander around. The art installation has continued to expand since it was founded by Hov in 2020. Robots are slowly but surely becoming part of everyday life, taking on human roles in different areas. Now, fast food restaurants can make French fries faster and better as a robot called Flippy 2 takes over the job.
When an order comes in through the restaurant system, it automatically spits out its instructions to Flippy. It takes a frozen product, fries it for the precise amount of time, and puts the finished product in the end. It does it faster, more accurately, more reliably, and happier than most humans do it.
Flippy 2 has been created in a robotic lab in California called MISO after 5 years of efforts by its developers. According to the project engineers, a really good understanding of the food science is needed to make sure the food quality is there, how different food sticks together, and how the temperature and heat affect it. The MISO CEO says the machine can cook several meals with different recipes simultaneously, removing the need for catering staff.
This technology utilizes a whole bunch of computer vision. There's cameras throughout the system, including right here we have these food identification cameras. The cameras not only guide the robot and tell it exactly where it is in space and how to move through this area, but also identifies the food type, and it knows the recipe for each one.
The MISO CEO says tasks like the fry station are the kind that humans are most happy to offload. The name Flippy comes from the original machine designed to flip burgers, which was not very useful for restaurants.
Freedom is an essential virtue that is valued not only by humans but animals as well. Just like two eagle owls that have been released into the wild after being born in a Madrid zoo. The two owl twins were freed after months of training to survive in the nature. First, they were taken to a big aviary to develop the necessary skills, including those for hunting prey. The aviary is designed to have a similar environment to the local mountain range. Meantime, they need to gain muscle and come to a suitable weight. After passing various skill tests, the owls are released as part of Madrid Zoo's breeding program of night birds of prey. 7 eagle owls and 11 barn owls have been released since the program was launched in 2017. However, some of them flew back seeking shelter as they failed to adapt to the nature.
Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
On the outskirts of China's metropolis, Shanghai, a tiny island has been dubbed Cat Island as it provides shelter for stray animals. Since it opened last month, a charity based on the island is taking in cats, mainly brought from Shanghai residents. These small carnivorous mammals are neutered and evaluated, and those with good temper and health are allowed to roam free on the island. The city's Stray Cats Management Center says their trap-neuter-release policy is to protect stray cats, limits their population, and maintain ecological balance. However, Shanghai has an estimated 200 stray cats per square kilometer, which means other methods will be needed to control the urban population, stray cats. A pair of baby panda twins make their debut appearance at the Chongqing Zoo in southwest China, with visitors flocking to cherish the abundance of cuteness.
Our returnee panda, Ershan, gave birth to the twin brother and sister on July 22nd this year. Currently, the elder brother weighs 4.3 grams and the younger sister weighs 0.6 grams. They're in good condition at present.
The twins' first public appearance was on Saturday, the first day of the week-long National Day holidays. During this week, the pair of giant panda cubs will be on display in the nursery of the panda house of the zoo. Their mother, Ershan, once lived in Canada as a goodwill envoy, but returned to her homeland in 2020. This was Ershan's second delivery of twins. A total of 21 pandas currently live in the Chongqing Zoo, which has been breeding giant pandas since the 1960s.
Hidden Files.
Are you old enough to remember the emotional story about Iraqi soldiers stealing babies from incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital back in 1991? A Kuwaiti teenager introduced as Nayira said she had seen Iraqi soldiers take 312 infants out of their incubators and put them on the cold floor to die. Well, this story made headlines around the world and was repeated by political leaders, especially by U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who wanted to go to war against Iraq. Or perhaps you may remember the weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, that Iraq allegedly had. In February 2003, then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, addressing the United Nations, claimed that Saddam Hussein was producing weapons of mass destruction. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence, Powell told the Security Council. And his address helped to win over the UN to wage war on Iraq in 2003. There's just one major problem with each of these stories, and that neither was true. But nevertheless, being false didn't stop these claims from causing havoc and destroying the lives of millions of people. Well, these are examples of what some may call an art, the art of propaganda. On this program, we will look at how propaganda was fine-tuned during World War I and why that matters to us today. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Over 100 years ago, in 1914, World War I broke out in Europe. Now, the Americans had declared neutrality, which was supported by both the president and the people. Edward Bernays was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he used his uncle's expertise in psychology with his own journalism background to create a way to make the unlikable more appealing. For example, when the American political elite had a change of heart and decided that the United States had to enter the war, they needed to figure out a way to convince a reluctant public of the need to get involved in that European war. Thus, the Committee on Public Information was formed, and its job was to change public opinion via mass persuasion. It was led by George Creel, and Bernays was a part of the group. There was a massive campaign of speeches, films, posters, etc., and it was extremely successful. CPI became the largest propaganda machine the world had ever seen up to that point. And its selling point was targeting the emotions of Americans without consideration of logic or even truth.
It was a plain publicity proposition, Creel recalled, a vast enterprise in salesmanship.
Creel was a pioneer, you might say, in the field of public relations. And then Wilson appoints him the head of something called the Committee on Public Information, which, not to put too fine a point on it, is essentially the U.S. government's agency for propaganda.
Creel saw his problem as transforming the American people into one white-hot mass of enthusiasm for the war. And the CPI went from a bureaucracy of one person to an army of about 100,000 people in the space of a couple of months.
The CPI mobilized movie stars for the Liberty Loan message. Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, all of the greatest stars of their day. Celebrity culture is just starting to emerge, and they can turn out crowds, and those crowds then become some of the biggest rallies that you see on the home front during the war.
Creel even found a way to push his message when the movie screens were dark.
In between every reel of film, there was a four-minute break when the projectionist had to change the reels. Someone at the CPI hit on the idea that this was a perfectly captive audience for the delivery of the war message.
Prominent members of the local community would stand up and deliver short patriotic speeches. They became known as the Four-Minute Men. And what began in movie theaters quickly spread to any venue where an audience assembled. In New York, Creel's volunteer army addressed 500,000 people each week. 10 men gave talks in Yiddish, 7 in Italian. President Wilson himself gave a 4-minute speech.
These 4-minute men would give a talk on some aspect of Americanism, why we are fighting, what are the principles we're fighting for.
The appearance of spontaneity masked a carefully scripted government message. These were no haphazard talks by nondescripts, Creel insisted. but the careful, studied, and rehearsed efforts of the best men in each community. Each speech aimed as a rifle is aimed, and driving to its mark with the precision of a bullet.
They were guided by a central authority, but always in the own words of the individual giving the speech, and he was usually a person who was known in the community. He was not saying, this is what the government says. He was saying, I'm an intelligent person, successful person, this is what I think, you should think this way too.
So propaganda, or as it became known as, public relations, was such a success during that war that afterwards it became a permanent fixture of American society and other places to sell anything from products that people may not need or not have the money for to wars that people had no interest in being a part of. Well, that was the roots of modern propaganda, but it has been fine-tuned with great sophistication and effect, and has led to the current world of television and modern media. Much has been invested in trying to direct the human psyche, and nothing has been more effective than mass media, where it can demonize those seen as the enemy or immortalize those seen as friends. Well, to help me take a closer look at all of this, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program.
Dr. Tim Anderson is director of the Sydney-based Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He worked as a lecturer and senior lecturer at Australian universities for more than 30 years, teaching, researching, and publishing on human rights in development, customary land in Melanesia, small farming and food security, health systems and infectious disease, Cuban medical internationalism, self-determination and development, independent regional integration, and resistance to the wars of the 21st century. His most recent books are Land and Livelihoods in Papua New Guinea, 2015, The Dirty War on Syria, 2016, now published in 10 languages, Countering War on Propaganda of the Dirty War on Syria, 2017, Axis of Resistance Towards an Independent Middle East, 2019, and The Pandemic and the Independent Countries, 2020.
Welcome to the program, Tim. I want to look at the concept of propaganda. I mean, the way it was used in the past, and also if we look at how it's used today.
We're looking at virtually a century of propaganda used in society generally, but in particular in relation to war, as you mentioned, the First World War and where Bernays' ideas were developed, I suppose. And there was a great effort to try and persuade the US public back then, 100 years ago, to get involved in what was essentially a European war between a reconfiguration of power between the old empires. And that had a role also in empowering the US voice, and the US, including the US Zionist voice, in British politics of the time, which of course became important because the British and the French were the colonial powers that took over the old Ottoman Empire and started to carve up the Levant, and particularly of course Palestine, and the Balfour Declaration was part of that. So the role of the US Zionists in that propaganda a century ago is an important one to remember. Now, if we look at the type of propaganda today, I believe it's far more sophisticated. I think that they are dealing with more highly educated populations. The systematic character of the propaganda and the messages, as Bernays said, emotional messages, more important than the actual facts. You know, for example, we look at a particular incident becomes much less important than the overall messaging that's going on around that particular incident. And that's very important today, I believe, in hybrid wars that are largely led by the liberal side of US imperialism, which likes to have proxy wars. It likes to have propaganda wars, economic wars, and so-called smart power, which is about getting other people to fight their wars and other people to finance their wars.
I mean, propaganda may not be based on truth. I want to look at how dangerous that is for us, especially today.
I said populations are more educated these days, not necessarily that they're more intelligent, but in some ways very simple people with strong values sometimes understand these issues better than more highly educated populations. That's the sad reality. And those of us in Western cultures or English-speaking cultures, let's say, have to deal with as a huge challenge. Why is it that people swallow the weapons of mass destruction, lies, the Gaddafi feeding Viagra to his troops? They're using that same lie against the Russians at the moment. There are so many recycled fictions that are used to disarm a population and to get rid of the opposition to the latest war, the latest proxy war, for example, that it depends on techniques that are quite constant. And of course, one part of it is the domination of the media, the control of the social media to a large extent, the insistence, the repeated nature of these lies, like the chemical weapons in Syria, repeated for year after year after year, until it comes to a point where people can't imagine that there wasn't some truth to this particular lie. But you've also got, I believe, on the part of Western audiences, a predisposition to want to believe that they are helping in some way, or they are on some human rights crusade when they back the latest economic war or military intervention against the country. It's an extraordinary thing, and I think it bothers me as an educator in a Western society that we have to really start studying the nature of stupidity in Western populations, because it's not all about information. It's also about people's emotional predisposition to believe these sorts of fictions about the character of war after war after war. I mean, thinking people have to raise some questions, but nevertheless, the propaganda machine relies on, it depends upon the fact that there are all these reinforcing messages and those questions don't really reach a very high level.
Well, another part of propaganda is demonizing the other and controlling information. For example, on certain platforms right now, we see how Press TV or RT are labeled as state-controlled media. But when it comes to VOA or BBC that are government-funded, that is not the case. So already from the beginning, when someone looks at these alternative pages or networks, they'll be met with negative feelings or perspective. I mean, your take on all of this?
They put those tags in an extremely partisan way. Voice of America, of course, is completely funded by the US government, but same with the BBC. But they claim there's some difference between the BBC and Press TV, for example, in character. Of course, there isn't. I mean, there's other important mechanisms which you will find fairly readily through experimentation. The search engines, for example, if you search human rights and Iran, for example, you're going to find a huge number of sources from the US and from Britain and from their embedded NGOs, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and so on. But if it's Iran talking about human rights, you'll have to look very carefully to find those references. The same with China. If you want to find China's report on human rights in the US and you search China, human rights US, you will find everything about the US saying human rights in China, and you'll look very hard to try and find what China is saying about human rights in the US. So there are a number of mechanisms there that are at play to deliberately curtail the flow of information, to prevent people from accessing a range of information and channeling it down to repetition of the same sources.
So, I mean, when there are so many controls put in place, what is key in order to discern truth from fiction in this massive world of propaganda?
I find very encouraging the fact that there are good media collaborations between Latin America and West Asia. And one of the examples is Almayadeen, for example, which is largely in Spanish and Arabic and now beginning in English. And that's really a collaboration between independent West Asian media and independent Latin American media. Then you have Hispan TV, which is a collaboration with the same with independent Latin American media, Iranian media in Spanish. Then we have Telesur itself, which is a continental network in Latin America, which is still a very powerful and universal source of information in Latin America. So the Russians also have some collaborations, the Chinese to a more limited extent now, but at least we're seeing with the division of the world into big blocks that you can go to large media organizations in China, in India, for example, if you want to get some independent sources of information about what's happening in Ukraine, for example. But the domination of the Anglo-Americans of media sources is something that's been there for a long time, and it's developed a great capacity, and it's a huge advantage that the Anglo-Americans have in the world of propaganda.
Well, I appreciate your insight into all of this. Thanks so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. Well, remember I mentioned the Kuwaiti girl at the top of the show who talked about what she had witnessed.
Thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name. And again, we ask our friends in the media to respect the need to for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait. My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my five-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after an invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying.
Well, just remember, no matter how emotional that appeal was, everything she said was a lie. Nayira was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Her fake testimony played a role in the killing of 1.5 million Iraqis dying from starvation due to U.S. sanctions, and tens of thousands of Iraqis dying during the U.S. 1990s war Desert Storm. But no one ever held Nayira, nor did they hold the United States accountable for this falsehood. Millions of Iraqis lost lives and millions of disrupted lives were left behind. And a big part of it was all due to a lie. Propaganda can kill if packaged with the right covering. So be careful and stay aware. That brings us to the end of the show. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and I hope you will join myself and all the crew right here next week for Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.